Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 105, The Well. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we are here continuing our series on spiritual entrepreneurship, in particular the organizations that are part of the first cohort of Moshe House's Open Door Project. Today, we are joined by Dan Horowitz, who is the founding director of an organization based in Detroit called The Well. Dan Horowitz is a rabbi, but prior to becoming a rabbi, he was a lawyer. And earlier in his career, he served as the rabbi and director of immersive learning for Moshe House itself. In our conversation, we'll learn about how Dan Horowitz was taken by the idea of a progressive version of Chabad, and he started The Well with the seed of that idea. But it will be interesting in our conversation to see how the idea has grown and changed since then. In Dan's words, The Well is a, quote, inclusive Jewish community building, education, and spirituality initiative geared to the needs of young adults and those who haven't connected with traditional institutions. The organization's core belief is that Jewish community, ethics, values, and spirituality can and should be directly applicable to our lives and should drive us to positively impact the world around us. Dan Horowitz, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited. So tell us a little bit about your organization, The Well, just so that we get a basic sense of what it is and what it's doing today.
I like to say that every good comic book or every good story has some sort of like transformative origin story, if you will. It's like every superhero needs the origin story that's like part of the backstory. So for me, I was staffing a couple of Birthright Israel trips back in like 2009, 2010, I was in law school at the time, and I was staffing these trips, and we get all of the participants ready and excited to go and visit the Kotel, to go to the Wailing Wall. And we go and we get there, it's late in the trip, and we've prepared these people for the spiritual moment. And as we know, there's a separate men and women section there, certainly at least at that time, it was before Robinson's Arch opened up, but there's the separate sections, and I'm the male counselor, so I take the, you know, self-identifying men to the men's section, and we go. And before we actually can get up to the wall, we're met by a Chabad rabbi who has a permanent tefillin cart installation. Tefillin are also known as phylacteries. And the question that this rabbi is asking of all of these young men that I'm leading to hopefully have this meaningful spiritual experience at the heart of Jerusalem, right outside where the temple used to stand, is your mother Jewish? And if the answer was yes, he would invite them over to lay tefillin, to wrap the tefillin around their arm and put on their forehead. And if the answer was no, he ignored them as if they were subhuman. And now, right before this, what would have been uplifting moment, you had this moment of separation, of judginess, of feeling not included in Judaism. And my feeling at that moment was, holy crap, where is liberal Judaism? And I say liberal not politically, but liberal non-Orthodox. Where is liberal Judaism's tefillin cart equivalent? Where is the warm, wrapping embrace to have people feel excited and welcomed into the community, to still have it be rooted deeply in tradition with meaningful content and all of those pieces, but in a way that was going to actually be inclusive of everybody who's identifying as a Jewish person. You know, we know nowadays, you know, what is it? Something like 50% of young Jewish millennials actually have parents who are interfaith. So to have that happen, it was a, oh my God, wake up moment. So I looked at my hometown of Metro Detroit, and I saw multiple Orthodox outreach organizations who were doing kiruv, or in-gathering kind of work, if you will. But there was really nobody outside of the physical synagogue structures and federation, which does awesome work, particularly in Metro Detroit. They are exceptional. But there were certain things that they couldn't do because it would be perceived as stepping on the toes of synagogues and other religious educational institutions. So there was a need and a void in that space for a truly inclusive Jewish voice to go and connect and build relationships with folks who, as we know, certainly at the very least during their 20s and 30s, are overwhelmingly not finding their homes within physical synagogue structures. So the original thought behind the well was, what would Chabad look like if it were liberal and actually inclusive? And that was kind of the origin of how we started in June of 2015.
Tell me, I know that you've really changed some of your framing for the well now, but let's go back to that time when you were starting to conceive of this liberal and inclusive Chabad. What was it that you thought such a thing would look like?
For me, it was a home-based Judaism. That was effectively the thought that we had walking into it. So that first year, we were hosting Shabbat dinner out of our house multiple times a month. Sukkot, we had 8 straight days of programming out of a super cool sukkah made out of recycled doors from City of Detroit teardowns and decorated in tribute to something called the Heidelberg Project, which is a well-known art installation in the City of Detroit that's just completely out there. And needless to say, it was certainly rewarding. It was exhausting. My wife is a saint because she did not sign up for that. and the transformative moment was actually when we had our second child, which was about a little over a year into having started the well, when it was like, we need a little bit more peace and quiet around the house. But that was also the impetus to really evaluate what we were doing. And what I saw was that we were building a Jewish community that was not empowered. It was rabbi-centric. It was, for you to have a meaningful Jewish experience, you come to my house, I'll create that experience for you, and then you'll walk away hopefully feeling great, but you're certainly not in a position to do anything that we just did on your own in your home. So that was really the moment where there was a significant shift in our organizational approach, and we actually moved away from striving to mimic Chabad or the certain pieces that we liked about Chabad in order to say, actually, we're going to strive to be empowerment-centric co-creators. We are going to help you host Shabbat in your home for the first time and coach you through that process and help you with the guest list and, yes, help underwrite if necessary and whatever it might be. We're going to go and raise some money to buy 7 sukkahs as an organization that we're going to lend out specifically to young adults who have never had a sukkah before in their own backyard and are excited about having the opportunity to build one, with the caveat that they have to invest in the roof and the decorations and in hosting at least one larger scale gathering of 10 or more people for a meal during the course of the holiday. So how do we kind of turn the model on its head and say, sure, we'll still host Shabbat dinner once a month, but those other 3 times a month, if one of them were doing a community-wide, you know, out-of-the-box service of some kind, those other 2, can we have at least 2 other young adults each month hosting Shabbat for the first time? So that was really a big change for us organizationally and is completely broadened our reach in terms of the types of people we're touching, the number of people that we're touching, lowering barriers to entry into community.
So the well, you've been around, I guess, about 2 years. I would love to know, just for our listeners to understand sort of the impact of what you're doing, you know, can you give us some statistics that you have on how many people are participating? And also, could you just walk us through kind of the basics of this is what the well does, you know, just kind of a sweep sense of, you know, these are some of our key program areas and, you know, a good sense too, of like, this is what we don't do.
So in our first 2 years, we statistically grew significantly when we moved away from the Chabad, everything has to be at my house model, and really rededicated ourselves to the empowerment centric co-creation model. You know, year over year growth. In year one, we had 65 young adults help plan and host a gathering for the Jewish community. In year two, that number jumped to 170 helped plan and host. Our shared interest groups have grown to the point now where I think we're at about 17 of them that meet every month. We had over 160 gatherings in year two alone after having 81 in year one. We had multiple thousand unique attendees at our programs and well over 5,000 in total attendance. And so that includes repeat attendees and the total attendance figure. And in a Metro Detroit Jewish community that really only has about 5,000 to 6,000 young Jewish and Jewish adjacent adults. Jewish adjacent is the term I use for those who are in relationship with Jews or who like hanging out with us. So it was really maybe 5,000 to 6,000 people even in that target market altogether. So to have had a couple thousand unique participants in our gatherings feels really good for really good in terms of market saturation, like hitting the market on any given month, including the 17 shared interest groups that are meeting. We are supporting something like 23 to 25 gatherings. So there's at least one additional program each week on top of shared interest groups, and usually more than that. We have a text-based learning series called CSI, Coffee Study Interpret, originally ignited by the Covenant Foundation, but obviously we are investigating the role of text and issues in our lives. But we are very, very intentional in two ways about that. First, we do not use alcohol or free alcohol as a draw in order to get people to come and do Jewish learning on principle. That's why it's coffee, not alcohol. And B, we were very intentional about framing overwhelmingly the topics for discussion around secular issues that people are really interested and passionate about, and bringing in expert secular speakers, and then using the time together, well, in a text perspective, to see what Jewish tradition and other traditions and any other gleaned human wisdom or newspaper articles or scholarly articles or whatever have to say about a certain topic, so that folks will walk out having a sense of, hopefully, appreciation for what the Jewish wisdom tradition might have to say about something, and how that fits into a broader universalistic world outlook that respects the different experiences and traditions of others as well. So everything from welcoming two Syrian Muslim refugees who had been resettled in Detroit to come and share their stories, to Judge Bernie Friedman, who wrote the DeBoer versus Snyder opinion that ultimately got looped into the Obergefell gay marriage decision by the Supreme Court. So he's the federal judge coming and talking about his experience of working on that particular case, to welcoming the CEO of the Detroit Zoo to come and talk about Haram Bey the gorilla after that happened in Cincinnati, where they euthanized the gorilla who had a three-year-old boy fall into the pen, to mass incarceration, to what makes food Jewish. So we do that at least once a month, a CSI. We partner regularly with other local organizations. We've had over 30 local organizations we've partnered with, some partnering on our stuff, sometimes partnering on their stuff. But say we do that at least once a month. We usually do at least one sort of out-of-the-box spiritual experience, whether it's Kabbalah yoga or Jewish mindfulness meditation or an alternative kind of service experience, worship experience, whatever we want that to look like, to help people connect in those ways, if that's how they connect. Shabbat dinner is a huge piece of what we're doing. So often, if it's not at my house, we're out at other people's houses in order to help them create and facilitate every month the Shabbat dinner experience. And then we have stuff that I would say our best stuff is the stuff that people bring to us. It's when people in the community are coming and saying, hey, we're really interested in making X happen. Can we try this? And what would that look like? And the response overwhelmingly is, yeah, of course, we would love to help you make that happen. How can we be of most help to you? And I would say we're doing at least something every month, because it's a community generated kind of, we want to explore this.
I do this all the time. I gotta ask about the name. So the well as a name is A in English, which we've spoken about with some of our guests in the past as an important feature of their name. And it's also, it's a little bit like cryptic to me. I'm like curious what the well is meant to signify for the people that are participating in its programming.
For sure. So we had lots of conversations with the early lay leadership group about what we were going to call this thing that we were building in terms of branding. And the decision was made that we wanted it to be in English so that it would be as inclusive as possible. And we started thinking about different names. You know, there was Hamakom and, you know, those kinds of things. But ultimately, it was my wife, whose name happens to be Miriam, who suggested who suggested that we call it The Well. And for those who don't know, there's Midrash, kind of the creative narrative part of our tradition, talks about Miriam, Moses' sister, as being the one who was responsible for the water, or the well, so to speak, that was with the children of Israel as they wandered in the desert for 40 years, that when she passed, the wells dried up, those kinds of things. So it was fitting that it should be Miriam that came up with that idea of the well. But when we dove into it, when we dove into like
Lex loves those kinds of linguistic
pushing all the best buttons today. Great.
So when we dove in, we were really excited, both because of traditional kind of symbolism over water not only being a source of sustenance, Torah being likened to water, something that has you feeling physically rooted, but that you take away with you, you know, all of those kinds of pieces. Plus, if you look at everything that happened in the Bible, if it was cool, it happened at the well. It was the singles bar. It was the office water cooler. It was the hangout spot. It was all of those things. Not so nice things happened there too, mind you, but at least biblically. But we really liked that kind of oomph, if you will, that it could have for those in the know or wanting the know, that kind of biblical groundedness and rootedness and intentionality behind bringing tradition forward, while at the same time being as inclusive as possible to the broader Jewish community and beyond.
Who are the folks? It's a broad question. What are some of the different categories of folks that are finding meaning and community in the well? And what would you say about the well, for example, and its audience distinguishes it from other kinds of opportunities that people have to engage Jewishly in your area?
There's a broad range of people that are taking advantage of the community that we're striving to build here. And we have folks who are involved with the well who are not Jewish themselves exploring Judaism, who are not Jewish significant others, whose partners happen to be Jewish, and who this is the first space they've truly felt included in and welcomed into. We have, you know, at any given time, we have 15 to 20, with obviously the goal to grow those, what we call shared interest groups that others might call micro communities or clusters, usually of 8 to 12 people that kind of get together each month around a shared passion or interest. The well has 5 women's Rosh Chodesh groups. Each one has at least one non-Jewish significant other who happens to be part of it and is finding a connection to Jewish community and Jewish spirituality and understanding their partner and the kind of home that they might build together better through these. And on the other end, we've got people who are involved who have 3-year-olds who have already joined synagogues. You know, I've got someone who's on my board who's a board member of a conservative synagogue. And plenty of people who view what we are doing as a significant value add above and beyond their synagogue membership, because we're doing the kinds of programming and community building that speak to them that most synagogues are not equipped to do for the 20 and 30s demographic. Coupled with the fact that Detroit is a really different town. There was a massive, massive exodus from the Metro Detroit area for many, many years. And then the economy collapsing in 2009 certainly didn't help that at all. And we started to kind of curb that trend, which is really nice. But what it effectively means is that if you grew up in Metro Detroit and stayed here or left and came back or married someone from here and moved here, which I would say is probably 90% of the young Jewish adult population in Metro Detroit, you have ingrained family customs. You likely already have synagogue loyalties, because this community has historically an unbelievably high affiliation rate, almost 50% historically affiliate with synagogues, maybe a little lower now. So what effectively happens is you have people who may have a family affiliation with Temple A, but they're really good friends, partially because they have to be, because so many of their other friends have left town. They're really good friends with people who belong to synagogue or shul or Temple B, and they want to do Jewish things together. They want to connect together within community. And it may be that we worship in different places and our affiliations are in different places due to legacy ties, but we still want somebody to help convene us together around meaningful Jewish experiences. So we're finding that for those who are already synagogue affiliated in their early to mid 30s, even late 30s with young kids, that they're finding a connection with us too. Originally, we started the well using the word pluralistic, but the reality is that we're not pluralistic, and I'll be ready to admit that. Inclusive itself is a really challenging word. So we switched. There's no good word, because I didn't want to use liberal, because while in the UK, liberal means not Orthodox, you know, left Judaism. In the States, liberal inherently has political ties. So we thought a lot about what word to use, even in our mission statement and how we wanted to present. And ultimately, we chose inclusive while recognizing that inclusive Judaism is inherently of exclusive of those who we don't perceive to be inclusive. And owning that and recognizing that. So, you know, I grew up a little bit more traditional, and my training rabbinically is a little bit more traditional. So, you know, if somebody comes and keeps strict kosher, we'll obviously make sure we provide a kosher meal for somebody if they require a kosher meal, just as we would make sure that we have gluten-free options and dairy-free options and, you know, all of the other beautiful Eastern European Jewish stomach ailments. But we have so wonderfully inherited. So obviously in that regard, but we have plenty of programs that happen on or start before Shabbat is over. We have plenty of programs that are catered to a vegetarian, non-kosher certified standard from any random restaurant, because that meets the needs of the overwhelming majority of our people. And inclusivity, the way we're approaching it, does not necessarily mean catering to what, you know, is kind of jokingly referred to as the frumest common denominator, even if that means that we are inherently being exclusive of some. And I acknowledge and recognize that challenge.
What's really interesting to sort of tease that out is that it's fundamentally growing out of, I think what we've been talking about a lot on the podcast is like, what would it look like if these kinds of initiatives were growing out of the people who are not participating in the existing structures and organizations and was really starting from their experience. So if it was starting from their experience, then it would say, well, why would it be kosher? None of us keeps kosher. Then you say, well, but somebody might come who does keep kosher. Oh, well, then of course we would accommodate them, right? We would want to be, you know, we would want to have audacious hospitality, as we recently talked to April Baskin about or whatever. But the audacious hospitality is being expressed towards those who do keep kosher, as opposed to being expressed towards those who don't keep kosher. And that's not a philosophical, you know, argument. It's simply a natural result of something that's emerging out of the experience of the people who have not been participating. And somehow I think it's hard for us to wrap our minds around that because we kind of look at it from the perspective of, like, you know, I guess what we've also learned to call the elite versus the folk approach to Judaism, that says, you know, Judaism fundamentally is this thing that's defined by a set of rules and regulations, and you can accept the rules or not accept the rules, but don't come in here and tell me that, you know, my vision for a Jewish organization is going to somehow not pay any attention to those rules and is going to be just as authentic as one that does.
For me, I keep the traditional Hebrew. Whenever we're offering blessings at anything that we're doing, I always provide transliteration for anyone who might not read Hebrew. But my translations are overwhelmingly what I would call inspired by the original text, but are written in order to be as broadly inclusive as possible. So the standard kind of blessing of Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Asher Kidshanu Mitzvotav Vetzivanu, I translate as, we acknowledge the unity of all and express gratitude for the opportunity to connect by. So for me, mitzvah isn't commandments because I'm not at a place where I'm believing in an interactive God who is commanding me to do certain things. But it is an opportunity to connect in a meaningful way, whether with community, whether with the energy or spirit of the world, whether with family, whatever that situation might be. So you'll see that a lot in terms of the kind of language choices that we're making as a community and the materials that we're producing and disseminating. And what I love about it is that even if you are a traditional believer, to talk about the concept of acknowledging the unity of all, some might say it sounds Unitarian Universalist on the one hand, but it's a very Jewish concept that all is one, Shema, the Shema alone, or the notion Kabbalistically of Ein Sof, there is no end, right? Like, all is one and we are all one. So if you're a believer, you can fit into a traditional Jewish construct with that. And if you're not a believer, you know, I appreciate Amichai using the language of God optional and those kinds of pieces. But like, if you're not a traditional believer, the way that traditional Judaism might suggest you should be in terms of covenant or commandedness or even in God, that the unity of all, that's still a concept that resonates very much with 20 and 30 somethings who are universalistic in their outlook.
Could we take a moment to explore that retention of the Hebrew original? Only because I think there's something deep there that Lex and I think we've talked about a little bit maybe on the show, but we've talked a lot about it off the air, this question of the Hebrew. And is it only in your mind sort of a retention of the tradition, or is it something else? Because I think in our conversations, you know, at least one of the things where I'm emerging from it is like, it's almost like in a world in which most American Jews don't speak Hebrew or don't speak Hebrew very well, then there's a strong argument to say that the Hebrew doesn't actually mean what the Hebrew words mean. That what the Hebrew means is a sense of connection to tradition, which is why you want to keep the words, because they have a certain rhythm, they have a certain sound that many people have heard before and that feels like Judaism to them. But actually, if they did understand it, you would want to change the words. But it's actually because they don't understand it, or they don't understand it very well, or even someone like me who's fluent but doesn't really think about the words that much, you know, that actually what it is much more of a kind of a mantra or some kind of connection to tradition that sort of transcends the words and actually, you know, and I think that's actually sort of something that's hard for people, including us, to fully wrap our minds around. But I'm interested in whether that's also at the root of your thinking on it.
For sure. I agree completely. I think a piece of it is that some of my own formative Jewish memories were watching my father and grandfather say Kiddush over a cup of wine. And now that I have children of my own, having that opportunity to do that and share that and pass that down certainly feels good, feels authentic. I agree completely with you that I think Hebrew and praying in Hebrew is actually one of the best things historically that the Jewish people has had going for them. Because if people knew what they were saying, they would stand up and walk out. It's very hard to say things that you don't actually believe in. And I don't remember if it was when Rabbi Rami was on the show a while ago, whatever it was talking about, like he just got so tired of having to like recontextualize every single sentence in the prayer book. And he's there at the end of sentence three trying to recontextualize and they're already done with the prayer. So I totally relate to that experience. And you use the word mantra. I agree completely. For me, I love singing in Hebrew, praying in Hebrew, those pieces, because I can get lost in it, because I don't have to think about every single word as I'm saying it, because it has that rhythm, because it's the music that actually moves me. And my dream prayer service probably actually has no words and is all just nigunim, which are the wordless melodies, lie, 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 nai, 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 die, die, die. And that to me is going to move me spiritually just as much as actually offering words would.
It was Rabbi Rami, and that was one of my favorite moments of the podcast so far. I'm glad you called us back to that. So I want to slightly shift gears because you talked a little bit about Detroit, and I'm like really interested to poke a little bit more into the geography of this, because if we were to look at all of our guests, we've mostly featured people who are living in larger Jewish metropolises like New York, like the Bay Area, we could list them all off, but larger than, and Detroit's no micro community. It's a large place, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about if you think that the reason that you've been able to pull off something like The Well is that you're in a context like Detroit, or if perhaps it's been harder because you've got a smaller community, but the fact that you've succeeded means that it could happen somewhere else. I mean, like, I don't know which angle you'd come at it from, but I'm particularly interested because I grew up in Milwaukee, which I think of as a sister city of Detroit. And I think that there are a lot of communities, and a lot of our listeners are spread all over the place, definitely not in just big metropolitan areas, who might look at Detroit even as like a super mega Jewish community. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on sort of this geography question.
Detroit's a really incredible city, but the reality is that for a long time now, the overwhelming majority of the Jewish community has lived in the suburbs, just outside the city and even further beyond. There was an uprising in the late 60s in which the African American community rose up against those who were oppressing them. Which led to significant white flight, the Jewish community included amongst them at that point, starting to be perceived as white and kind of moved out to the burbs deeply. There's healing that's happening, but much more healing that has to go. Most people don't realize that the square mileage of the city of Detroit is the same as Manhattan, Boston, and San Francisco combined. But there are currently fewer than 700,000 people living within the city limits. There are fewer than 1,000 Jewish people, by every reasonable estimate, living within the city limits. But there's probably another 59,000-ish or so, or maybe a little more, living in different suburban areas outside the city. I think that The Well has taken off in Metro Detroit, partially because, admittedly, I'm from here. I grew up here. I had ties here. I was in relationship with many of the influential people in the community who were excited about and interested in what this could be and where it was going. But also, the sweet spot, and I haven't shared this yet, we're actually finding that the sweet spot that we're hitting in terms of age demographics is really like 27 to 37. we're not hitting the kids right out of school who are looking to party and bar night and network for work and those pieces. We're really striving to bring intention to having substantive content to just about every one of our gatherings in some meaningful way. And that effectively is attracting people who are actively seeking their partner, have found their partner or engaged to their partner or recently wed to and have welcomed their first or even their second child with, but for the most part are not yet at Hebrew school stage, which is kind of the handoff stage as we're envisioning it. And I should note that if you're here in Metro Detroit, it's overwhelmingly because you chose to be here in Metro Detroit. So given that people are looking to be here long-term and to lay down roots, they want to build community as juxtaposed with the big cities where it's incredibly transient and it's 2 years in LA and 2 years in San Francisco and a year and a half in DC and, you know, whatever it might be. And I'm sure that the communities there are struggling even in their fundraising to be able to say like, yes, we're raising money to invest in these people who will not be here long-term to invest in us and in this community necessarily. Whereas in Detroit, I feel like I have a much easier sell to be able to say, you know, I hate to talk about it in the language of selling, but like it's a much easier sell to a potential investor in our work to say, we are cultivating deep and meaningful relationships and building community with these people who for all intents and purposes are overwhelmingly likely to stay in Metro Detroit long-term if they're here between those years of 27 and 37. And that's a really attractive and intriguing opportunity. And it's why I agree. I think if we were to ever to expand or franchise or simply help other communities, I think Pittsburgh, Cleveland, St. Louis, Minneapolis, Milwaukee, I think those are all logical places that are comparatively similarly situated where the model could potentially be an effective one.
You know, I want to make this distinction between what the Well is and aspires to become versus other kinds of Jewish organizations that exist. Is the Well profoundly different from a synagogue, for example? Is the Well sort of charting a course that could eventually consolidate into being some kind of new type of synagogue? Or is the Well sort of fundamentally making something new in the world? And what is that? And is it something that fundamentally functions as a bridge between, you know, younger, you know, the just out of college bar time and the join a synagogue time, and the Well is the bridge? Or is the Well actually something that potentially starts at that age of just after you get married or just before or whatever, and then potentially grows up with you and becomes something new?
I don't see us becoming our own independent synagogue. I don't see us offering Hebrew schools or bar bat mitzvahs or things of that nature, partially because there are lots of folks who are doing that kind of work in Metro Detroit already and who do it very, very well, partially because the donor class in Metro Detroit is really not interested in that because most of them are also affiliated with traditional institutions and want to see them succeed. And our revenue model is definitely based on the investment of those who have means who are also supporting these other institutions and want to see them do well. And partially because I really personally don't want to be a pulpit rabbi. And if I did, I would go to a synagogue and start and work for a synagogue in a pulpit capacity. But aspirationally, that's, for me at least, not at all where I'm looking to go.
So where do you think that a person goes who, let's say, you know, 10 years from now, there's a person who connected with the Well at 27 and, you know, they got married at 33 and had a couple of kids and now they're 37, but they're not religious, they don't believe in God, they've loved all these things that they've done through the Well all these years, and they don't want to join a synagogue. So what do they do?
So first of all, don't forget, Metro Detroit is the home of secular humanistic Judaism. So Rabbi Sherwin Wein was here, his founding synagogue is here, the International Institute for Humanistic Judaism is based here. So if there are still those who want Jewish cultural community and context, but you know the traditional religious synagogue aspect won't speak to them, that is something that exists in Metro Detroit in a way that it doesn't necessarily in many other communities. So too, I don't necessarily think synagogue is the only way. I don't think that's the only way or the right way to necessarily live what people perceive as authentically Jewish lives for themselves. I think that as we get closer to that, admittedly, most like our average participant right now is probably 31, 32. So we're not quite there yet where we've started actively facilitating handoffs, but I do see that coming up in the next 5 to 7 years, clearly. A piece of it will be knowing the people well enough based on having cultivated relationships. I should note, we're all about you know, embracing the Ron Wolfson relational Judaism philosophy. I personally had 300 one-on-one coffees last year. And now that we're a full-time team of three, my team is actively out there having multiple coffee dates on a weekly basis. And that's the beginning of how we cultivate relationships and bring people into what we're doing without question. It takes the most time and it's the most rewarding thing that we do as far as I'm concerned. So I think that that's a piece, is having cultivated the relationship to know the people well enough to help facilitate handoffs. But as we grow and as we get closer to that time frame or that time when it's time to start doing that, my hope is that I'm going to be able to start spending some time with synagogues in town, as well as other Jewish communal organizations, to figure out how they can maybe start to look a little more like us and how we can start to look a little more like them in order to see if that makes sense.
Somebody might, you know, theoretically age out, quote unquote, from the well and find whatever opportunities, but it's likely that the people that they connect with are also aging at the same time. And that's the point where it might not just be about handoffs in the sense of to other institutions. It could be about those people taking, you know, their shared interest group and making it their own and making it, you know, a little bigger in some form. And so I guess on that front, I'd love to hear some examples of what these shared interest groups are doing. Because, you know, maybe there's listeners out there in some community who are like, you know, I don't have the bandwidth to start, you know, the well, the sequel, but I might have the bandwidth to start, you know, a group of 8 to 10 folks that are interested in some Jewish thing together.
So in my mind, the rationale behind the shared interest group, and it's not an original concept, if you want to look back to Chavura models and even earlier, the concept that I was really trying to dive at was, if you look at the way that organizations like Hillel International and Moshe House are measuring success in terms of what they perceive to be highly engaged participants, they often look at quarterly touches. If you're touching someone quarterly, that's a highly engaged participant if they're in that demographic. So for me, a piece of it was, could we challenge ourselves to say, look, life is crazy. Trust me, I've got two little ones at home and a startup and all of these people. Like, life is crazy. Can we get people to commit to once a month rather than once a quarter? Like, how many people can we inspire to want to get together as part of Jewish community to do something on a monthly basis? And as many people as possible as we can get doing that during these pivotal years, that feels like a huge win. So I think that was a piece of it. But at the moment, we've got 5 women's Rosh Chodesh groups. It's funny, you mentioned the well, how did we pick it? Maybe for a future interview, I have a good friend named Sarah Waxman who started an organization called At the Well, which is supporting Rosh Chodesh circles all over the world. And we buy resources from her that our groups use, and they're part of a broader, you know, broader community in that way, which is really special.
If you have a Twitter, that's going to be confusing because you'll have At the Well as your Twitter handle.
Yeah, no kidding. So we went with At Meet You At the Well, which is our website, meetyouatthewell.org. But broadly speaking, if you think it's confusing on Twitter, just imagine how confusing it is for grant proposals to national funders. But that's a whole separate conversation. So we have 5 women's Rosh Chodesh groups. We have 5 Shabbat dinner groups. We've got a few different whiskey groups. We've got a charity poker giving circle and another one that's about to launch. We've got Indian lunch buffet exploration group, because there are plenty of people, if they have partners, their partners don't appreciate Indian food, so they're looking for people to have Indian food with. We have a couple of Maj groups that are running at any given time. And we're always looking for meaningful ways to bring people together around shared passions and interests.
So, okay, I wanna revisit the Jewish adjacent issue question idea that you brought up, because you encapsulated some really beautiful things into a couple very quick sentences that I think could have floated right by for some people. And so no floating by, we're gonna hone in. You mentioned Jewish adjacent to you meant people who are in relationship with Jews and those who like to hang out with us. So often I hear people only focus on that former category, and I'm glad it's better than not thinking about people who aren't Jewish at all in your spaces. But I worry that we've taken one little baby step and not yet thought about, you know, there are people that like coming to, whether it's a conversation about Torah or an event to eat latkes, that aren't Jewish, but they are coming because Judaism has a lot of cool things to offer anybody. And there are people that want to hang out with us. So I guess, like, I'd love to hear more about why it is, because it sounds like you see success not just as, you know, reaching the Jews of Detroit, although that's clearly a core purpose, but also reaching the people of Detroit. And it'd be great to hear sort of how your philosophy goes into thinking about those questions and what kinds of roles people who aren't Jewish have found for themselves at the Well.
So thanks for bringing it back to this. And I think, again, I admittedly have drunk the Kula Kool-Aid a little bit on these kinds of things, if you will, where for me, he uses the language...
It's good Kool-Aid.
Exactly. He uses the language human flourishing. I frame it often as Maslowian in terms of self-actualization. I think that we have inherited a beautiful wisdom tradition, much of which is still meaningful today, and can help people self-actualize as they go on their life's paths and journeys. I don't think limiting that exclusively to Jews is a smart decision. I don't think that it's a practical or realistic decision. I'm not necessarily actively advocating for formal proselytizing in terms of trying to get people to convert, because that's not a priority of mine. But in terms of making them feel welcome within the communities that we're building, absolutely. I think the people who come to mind for me, I grew up in what was, you know, it's funny when you're a Jewish kid and you grow up in a school district that's 25% Jewish, it feels like everybody is Jewish. And everyone always says, oh, everybody's Jewish here, even though it's only like 25%. Because in the rest of the world, it's like 2%. In the rest of the states, at least, it's like 2%. So it feels like everybody's Jewish. But we all know those kids who are like super close with, there's like a group of friends. And out of the seven of them, four or five are Jewish. And two or three happen to not be, but that's the best group of friends. And they've been friends since forever. But of course, those kids were all going to bar mitzvahs growing up and going to celebrate different holidays at their friends' houses. And you know, they have an appreciation for, they've been to Passover Seders, they know this stuff. And if young Jewish adults are hanging out on a Saturday night, they're inviting their friends to come with them. So if we in some way say, hey, guess what? You're not invited anymore because you don't happen to be Jewish or anything along those lines, we're also going to lose all of the people who happen to be Jewish, who get to hang out so limited with their friends, and they want to hang out with their friends, and some of their friends are not Jewish. So creating spaces where everybody can feel welcome and included in that way, I think, is essential to not only making the community comparatively approachable broadly for those who happen to not be Jewish, but also really helps attract Jewish people to want to come to these things because they know that they can show up with their whole selves and with their whole friend group and not feel like it's going to be awkward for the others.
So can we talk a little bit about the economics of the Well? Because I think it's particularly fascinating. We've been exploring over the last few weeks and in the weeks ahead, you know, all these different ways that these kind of new organizations can get funded at the startup stage. What's, I think, relatively unique about the Well is that it's got this relationship with Temple Israel in West Bloomfield, one of the Detroit suburbs, which is the largest Reform synagogue in the country, probably the largest synagogue in the country. I looked at their website. They have no fewer than six rabbis, not including you. You don't appear on their website because there's kind of this sense where they're kind of incubating you, I guess, in some way, or they've helped the Well get off the ground. And there's not a sense that the Well's alumni, let's say, I mean, like you talked about earlier, some of them may join Temple Israel specifically, but even those who might go on and join a synagogue, well, some of them might join a conservative synagogue, right? And there's some way that Temple Israel has the vision to say, we can support this organization and not feel somehow it's competing with us, it's a threat, it's a concern, and instead to sort of say that it's something that they want to help get off the ground, even though it's not clear that it's going to help them so directly, at least in a massive way or in the short term.
For sure. So Temple Israel has been an incredible blessing, and in particular, Rabbi Paul Yedwab, who's one of the rabbis there. And Paul Yedwab took it upon himself effectively to secure the pilot grant for the Well. And to my knowledge, actually, the donor was not and is not a member of Temple Israel. So but Paul was in relationship. Her name happens to be Lori Talsky Zuckelman. You'll see the Lori Talsky Zuckelman Fund at Temple Israel is where all of our money is housed. And Temple Israel actually does not put any cash, so to speak, into that fund and does not take any out. But what they are providing is incredible in-kind support. I do not have to process payroll or reimbursements or those kinds of things. So they're taking care of the back end office side of things. I can use their health plan if I choose to, as can my employees, those pieces. So I'm incredibly grateful to them. And I think you hit it on the head, so to speak, the foresight and the vision to not have to say, hey, what's in this for us right now in the short term, but rather, and admittedly, it comes from a place of strength. They're the largest congregation in the country, as far as I know, with something like 3,400 family units. They come from this amazing place of strength to say, we want a raising tide to raise all ships. So I think that the language actually that they use, I think, Dan, they actually might have borrowed from you in a, like a continuing ed webinar that you used, that you did at one point, which was talking about Dayton Hudson and Target. And almost perceiving the well as disruptive innovator out there in the community, but checking out the trends, where are things going? And that's why I used the language earlier of R&D, where are things heading? And then do the existing institutions want to try to adopt some of those things, play with those things, you know, whatever it might be, in order to help them become more relevant to this next generation as they hit that stage, you know, those pieces.
Could you sort of paint the picture of like, where would this go if it were most successful in your mind? You know, what would be the way that Judaism was experienced in America in the 21st century?
That's a big question. Well, I think even now there are multiple Judaisms. There are already multiple Judaisms in terms of how people approach, practice, believe, all of those things. There's a real split in terms of most of the Orthodox world and the non-Orthodox world in terms of how we view the world and covenant and commandedness and all of those pieces. And I definitely see us moving further and further apart, mirroring the broader polarization that's happening in American society at the very least, which is challenging, to put it mildly. I think for me, it really comes down to how do we define success? If someone like me was invested in by the Jewish community, by the organized Jewish community at subsidized rates and federation allocations and all of those pieces for all those things. And then I somehow ended up starting some sort of chavura in Brooklyn, or wherever it might be. And we're there and there's 5 to 8 families and we just get together every month and we do our thing and we're living Jewish lives that way within community. And, you know, we may or may not give philanthropically to existing Jewish causes. You know, we really love art. We give to the art museum. You know, we're inspired by our Judaism to give to the art museum, you know, like whatever that might look like. Is that a success? Is that success for the Jewish community? And I think that you're going to get very different answers from people, depending on who you ask and where their institutional affiliations lie. Part of my role, as I perceive it, is to have both one foot in the institutional world as a product of, appreciator of, and supporter of, and the other foot in the non-institutional world, and seeing how, if and when, we can bridge those two together in meaningful ways.
Yeah, I think that's a really fantastic note to close on. Thank you so much, Dan Horwitz, for joining us. This has been awesome.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me, guys.
And thanks again, of course, to all of you out there listening to us. We always want to close out our episodes by mentioning how much we appreciate what you do when you slip in those headphones or you press power on your car radio. I guess it's, you know, the Bluetooth or the whichever setting on your radio, not the radio itself, but you get the gist. Thank you for listening. And we want to close out the episode by letting you know how to be in touch with us. And there's a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can check out our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us with a financial donation, either on a one-time basis or a monthly recurring gift. And you can do either of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.